Hi, everybody, and welcome back to another Hard Truth, where I'm delighted to be joined, as always, by my good friend, Alana Mercer. Yes. Hi, Alana.
Hi, David Vance, and we have a guest with us. I am honoured and delighted to introduce Daniel McAdams. Mm-hmm. Daniel has been doing the work of the Lord for decades, preaching to us Americans, stiff-necked people, shall I say, why current U.S. foreign policy is antithetical to peace, prosperity, and to life and liberty. He is he has served alongside Dr. Ron Paul in during his magnificent but trying time in Congress. Dr. Ron Paul obviously doesn't need any introduction, and Daniel has assisted and advised on matters of foreign policy, civil liberties, defense, and intel, which means delving into a lot of what the CIA does to our liberties. He's currently executive director of the Ron Paul Institute for Peace and Prosperity, and he co-produces and co-hosts with Dr. Paul the Ron Paul Liberty Report. Welcome, Daniel. It's lovely to see you.
Thank you very much. Thanks for the invitation.
So this probably is going to be a little bit discordant because my good partner, David Vance, is a little bit more down to earth than I am. And when I was thinking of you and this time that we've sort of shared over Gaza, all I could think of is really a lot of libertarian ideological issues and how the work that you've done meeting philosophy, anti-war philosophy with policy, how this impacts on this whole situation in Gaza. To me, personally, first, just to set the scene, and you obviously might not agree with me, I think that Gaza is a game changer. It is just more than just a foreign policy blunder that we swill around like mouthwash and move on. It seems to me that it is the crime of all crimes. The community that was in that landmass has been eradicated to all intents and purposes. The murder of the members of the community is ongoing. Yet the killers are walking among us, supported by the United States, replenished by the United States, serial killers, I should add. And they're parading around as if, in their country at least, as though heroes. And there's no censure from our powerful, hegemonic country. So what I'm going to ask you, actually, is Gaza just another foreign policy blunder as you see it, or is it something entirely different, of a different magnitude, on a different qualitative continuum?
Well, I think it's sort of the second war of the new age, if you would call it that, because I think what we saw when Russia, with the proxy war on Russia through Ukraine, was a radical transformation of the world system. The old system of the U.S. and, quote, the West, being able to dominate through the force of arms has come to an end. And I think we're seeing the rise of hybrid asymmetric warfare on many, many fronts. And I think that's one of the things that happened with the Ukraine war, because what happened after Russia invaded, you might call it Ukraine, is that all of the sanctions, all of the tools in the toolbox of the West completely and utterly failed. And in fact, the contrary, the opposite happened. They actually made Russia stronger. And they didn't make it stronger because sanctions are good for your economy, like some might suggest. However, it made them develop new synapses in the world, and they developed synapses with Iran and with India, and developed relationships even stronger with China. And it completely changed. Now we have the global majority, formerly the global South, which now acts in a very asymmetric way than how it's described. And I think, I don't want to belabor the point too much, but I think the Gaza invasion was the second such war of a new era, of this new era of global conflict. And I think we're seeing the same asymmetric forces at play. in terms of Israel behaving as the previous system where the use of blunt force would cow their adversaries into submission, well, that hasn't been the case. In fact, the opposite has happened. And you see the rise of non-state actors like the Houthis, who have been victorious in shutting down the Red Sea to people they don't want to be in the Red Sea. So I don't want to drone on and on, but I just think this is the second conflict of the new era. And as such, I think it's extraordinarily important.
Interesting.
Yeah, Daniel, can I just come in here? Because I go along with what you're saying, actually. I think the outcome of America, well, NATO's reaction in Russia, it's they've managed to make Russia great again, which is quite an irony, I think. And I was just looking at some economic data from Russia versus most of the European countries. And I'm delighted to see Russia is admirably outperforming the whole of Western Europe. So, you know, the old sanctions didn't work too well, did they? And so where Alana and I see most things more or less the same, I think. But and we both of us, when this whole thing started, Daniel, in Ukraine in the first instance, if Alana remembers, we were very quick to say, look, this is insane. But it was NATO provocation, in my view, Daniel, and it backfired on them, but it hasn't stopped them, has it? I mean, so it therefore doesn't surprise me that they keep going with this kind of stuff.
Well, it's now become exposed, though, as just a bold-faced grift, because everyone knows, even now, I mean, even the mainstream media in the U.S., and my guess is probably in the European and U.K. media as well, it's pretty much accepted that Ukraine is losing and will lose. They can't argue against that anymore. This whole, you know, 50 times you heard that Russia was out of missiles. Well, it's not. It's outproducing, the collective West in missiles and other equipment. So now they've admitted that it's not going to win. So the idea now is to stave off the inevitable destruction of Ukraine and destruction of certainly its male population. They're doing their best to destroy the female population as well. And it's all for the sake of the U.S. military-industrial complex, and to a lesser degree, I would think probably some of the European military firms, perhaps in Germany, what have you. Yep. But, you know, for example, and we can get into this, but the $61 billion to Ukraine, if you look at the finer points, it's very, very little of it is going to Ukraine. Most of it is going to Lockheed Martin and the other big arms manufacturers. It's corporate welfare for the wealthy at the expense of the entire population of Ukraine in a physical sense, but in an economic sense, the entire population of the United States, certainly the middle and working classes.
Yes, and quite a disgrace was the sight of our Congress waving treason-like Ukrainian flags and being shouted Republicans. Was that a majority Republican there, Daniel, waving? I think Daniel, David has a clip.
We've got a clip. Oh. Hang on. Let's observe the absolute horror. It's a very short clip. It only lasts for a few seconds. Play the clip. Look at that, Ukrainian flags in the U.S. House. What a disgrace. Who do the Democrats work for?
Well, who funds the campaigns? The military-industrial complex funds a lot of campaigns. Yep. And they're going to get their money, and a little bit trickles down to the think tanks, and a little trickles down to the media, and a little bit trickles down to Congress, and everyone is happy except the rest of us who have to pay for
it. But the speaker, the Republican speaker, after an interlude with the CIA, quickly, okayed this whole facade. How does that work? Didn't we trust Mr. Johnson?
Mr. Johnson is a cipher. I mean, if you look at this press conference he gave a couple of days ago, when he outlined the new axis of evil, what's one thing that was interesting about it is you saw him repeatedly look down like this at his hand. What he was looking at was talking points. Those were not written by him. Those were written by a staffer. You know, members of Congress come and go, but staffers are forever, right? Mm. And they're the ones who really control things behind the scenes. You could call them a kind of deep state, which is what they are. But he didn't have any idea what he was saying. he was looking down. And I know because I worked on the Hill for 11 years, at least 11 years. And most members would say, listen, don't bother me with the facts. Don't bother me with the details. I don't need a long thing. Just get me talking. Give me five talking points. You know, and Dr. Paul wasn't like that.
So he was bought and paid for by lobbyists.
Just tell me what to think. Yes. Tell me what to say. Tell me what the prevailing wisdom is on this. They're extremely incurious people, for the most part, people in the U.S. House of Representatives. There are a couple of exceptions that stand out, Thomas Massie being one of them. Exactly. But by and large, extraordinarily incurious, narcissistic individuals.
Yeah. I'm happy you brought up Thomas Massie. I thought his vote with, and I wanted maybe to segue into the possibility. I'm always thinking of, we are so marginalized. Would you characterize yourself as a libertarian of the right? I do think of myself as someone of the libertarian right.
Yeah, I don't know exactly what I would classify myself as. I guess I would just say I'm anti-state, certainly in the way it's constructed now. I guess, you know, culturally, I'm a traditionalist. I believe in traditional culture, but I'm certainly not a conservative or a liberal, or looking around at libertarians. I don't know that I want to be in their crowd either.
So just to segue into the progressive left. The progressive left is certainly the dissident progressive left. The on the podcast, they've been very strong on the issue of Gaza. Very coherent and strong. And I sometimes wonder about maybe reviving that thought that Ron Paul shared with Murray Rothbard and Lou Rockwell about, you know, reaching out to members of the progressive left, at least on matters, let's say, they're not very good on Ukraine, I believe. Mm. But let's say even narrowing it down on matters like Gaza. And you bring up Thomas Massie, very interesting that he voted together with 13 Democrats, progressive Democrats, against censure of Iran's response. There was this, they always have these petty, you know, just show-offs, you know, these little votes about just to preen, you know, to preen and make sure we know what values, what solid values they hold. But there was this vote about censuring or condemning Iran's response to Israeli aggression. Thomas Massie sided with 13 progressive, the only Republican. What did he think about that? I thought that was quite interesting. Well,
one of the things that Thomas Massie does, which is remarkable, is that he does go through the bills very carefully. Now, he must have a good staff. I know his chief of staff, and he seems like a very sharp guy. I'm sure he has other people on the staff that are smart as well. But Thomas Massie, he's a very smart man. He's an MIT graduate. He holds several patents. He's a self-made man before he went to Congress. He had nothing to prove by going into Congress. In fact, he had everything to lose because he has, you know, everyone punching him in the face all the time. But he actually reads these things. And I didn't read his statement on that particular vote you're discussing, but my guess is he went through the language very carefully and found a few little tiny opening doors, a little cracks in the door that would enable, for example, sanctions or some sort of a military action against Iran in the future.
Really?
That's often what it does. There had to be something in it. It would be my guess. I would be interested to go back and read a statement on it.
Interesting. But it's also principled, because if you look at the principle of the thing, he's correct. And why would you condemn Iran for restoring some regional balance with its really theatrical show of force after Israel killed 13 of its people in a protected sovereign territory in Damascus?
The interesting thing about taking the position that Thomas Massie takes, which was essentially what the Ron Paul position was, which is non-intervention, is that it's actually a lot easier because you're relying on a philosophy, you're relying on a, you know, consistent set of principles, and so he doesn't have to explain away each vote. So why did you vote against aid to Israel? Well, I vote against all aid. You know, I don't believe in it. Yes. Why did you not vote to condemn so and so? Well, I don't believe that's our job to condemn other countries, you know. Yes. So it makes it a lot easier to do.
Yeah, but there are some people, and I wanted to play another short clip, less than 60 seconds, of an absolute intellectual giant who presides in the House. And I think his name is Gerard Connolly. Mr. Gerard Connolly. Yeah, hang on. So
I was just smiling. I have a surprise in
listen to this absolute grade one lunacy. Go.
Some say, well, we have to deal with our border first. The Ukrainian-Russian border is our border. It's the border between depraved autocracy and freedom-loving people seeking our democratic way of life. Do we have a stake in that outcome? Yes. Undeniably, yes. Will we rise to the occasion? Will we stand shoulder to shoulder with our Ukrainian brothers and sisters who for 1,151 days have been holding off the depraved, thuggish dictator Vladimir Putin, who has respected no norms of warfare? He's targeted children in hospitals and schools. He's bombed apartment blocks, killing thousands. Some say, well, we have to deal with our border first. The Ukrainian.
So where do we even start with this guy? Who knew the Ukrainian border, even though it's about, 5,000 miles away, is actually your border? Surprised about that, Daniel?
Well, I thought someone mixed up his notes and he was talking about Gaza, blowing up hospitals and killing children,
Exactly.
But here's the thing about someone like Connolly. He's been in there forever. That's number one. And number two, he represents the part of Virginia where a very large number of CIA agents, NSA agents, all of the deep state people work, and also the military contractors. He works in, he represents Fairfax County, which is the second wealthiest county in the United States of America. And they're not wealthy because they make a lot of good stuff people want to buy. On the contrary, and the most wealthy county is just one county over, Loudoun County. And that's where the people retire after they finish in Fairfax County. They move to Loudoun County and get a couple of horses and spend their millions. So these are his constituents, extremely wealthy people whose wealth is the sole, is solely derived from nefarious warlike business. Yes.
War profiteers. Yeah. And what's the difference between he, a Democrat, and Lindsey Graham?
Zero.
No. Exactly, Alana. I mean that these people, and you and I have chatted about it. Alana and I have covered, like Lindsey Graham, out and out warmonger, absolute disgrace. And looking at the US sort of political system from a distance, as I do, it kind of horrifies me because sometimes we look to the states for hope, if you like, for something better than the rotten political systems that we have here in Europe. But I have to say, I don't see much evidence of it at all, not in the terms of those represented there. And be it Lindsey Graham, Alana, it's a great point. Lindsey Graham, Jerry Connolly, it's the same person, isn't it, really?
To a large degree. I mean, there are some interesting developments, though. I mean, on the aid to Ukraine, more Republicans voted no than voted yes. And that's an interesting point when you think about it. So that means a couple of things. Speaker Johnson had to literally rely on Democrats to pass that bill.
Yeah.
So he essentially is not the Republican speaker. He's a Democrat speaker. He had to do a workaround with his own rules committee because his own rules committee would not report out a rule. So he used Democrats on the rules committee to report out a very, very restrictive rule that severely limited debate and severely limited the ability of anyone opposed to these aid bills being able to speak on the floor. So there are shifts happening. In the old days, when Dr. Paul was in and there was there would be a bill like this, you'd have very small handful of Republicans voting no on this kind of aid. So having the majority is significant, I think.
Okay, so we'll give the Republicans that.
Some of them.
Something is moving on Ukraine. But what about Gaza? There's absolutely nothing there. There's no ray of hope on the Republican side, is there?
No, there isn't at all. In fact, there were a few Republican no's on the aid to Israel, Thomas Massie being one of them, and a few that surprised me, and I was happy to see. Marjorie Taylor Greene, who is rabidly pro-Israel, she voted no on it, which was a good move on her part, I think, to do. But the only movement happening right now in terms of Israel is the fact that Biden's people are panicking, not because they give a damn about all the children and women and frankly, men who are being slaughtered and tortured there. But because his numbers are gone, have gone into the tank,
yes,
and he's losing important swing states like Michigan. And that's the only reason we're seeing some crocodile tears coming out of the administration.
Yeah. What do you think of the uncommitted vote among progressives and Democrats?
It's significant, and they're sending a message, and I think it's message received. And that's why I was going to put it up on our show, but there's an incredible juxtaposition where you have one article, I think it may be the same publication. In one article, it was Blinken warning Israel that the laws of war will, you know, we have the Leahy rule, where the U.S. cannot provide military assistance to any country
to a war criminal, yeah.
Oh, yeah, to any country that's committing war crimes, the U.S. cannot provide military aid. So on the one hand, Blinken warned them about this Leahy law. And then literally across in the same publication, I think it was, Biden is mulling the sale of another $1 billion worth of weapons to Israel. So, you know, they're having it, trying to have it both ways.
Is that purely for electoral reasons, do you think, Daniel? Is that because they are trying to play all sides basically to try and maximize the vote?
Well, I'm hoping that you both have vomit bags with you, but I saw Nancy Pelosi, one of the greatest Zionist hawks that you would ever imagine, actually wearing a Palestinian pin on her coat during this debate on Israel aid. So this shows you the level of depravity of someone like this, her entire career has been involved suppressing and oppressing Palestinians, you know, living in Gaza and in the West Bank. And here she comes out and she rolls out her brand new Palestine pin when she sees there's a political gain to be had from it.
But even the progressive AOC has only recently come around. So how opportunistic can someone who appeared to be a left progressive idealist, how cynical was that when she was being chased on the streets of New York or Brooklyn, wherever it was, by activists saying, say something about genocide in Gaza. And even she only recently, eloquently spoke to what's happening.
Yeah, it's political expediency. But, you know, there's this, I don't know if how active either you are on Twitter X, but there's an account there that is called APAC Tracker.
Yes.
All of a sudden it came out of nowhere. And it's very simple. There's no rude language. There's no vulgarity. It just simply shows how much each member receives from the pro-Israel lobby in terms of campaign funding. And it's significant in some members. In some members, it's very significant. And they say, okay, that explains it. In other members, it's very low. And you're thinking, gosh, you have a very low price that you charge for being a prostitute.
Yeah. Speak to that. Do you have any numbers or more? Flesh that out for us, the APEC influence.
It's enormous. And it's not just that specific. There are other organizations that that provide financing, campaign financing, and not only to those who do their bidding, but those who against those who oppose them, who don't vote the right way. You know, I mean, that's exactly what happened to Cynthia McKinney, if you remember back 15 years or so ago. She was a left African-American black left progressive.
Yeah.
And she wasn't a huge fan of Israel for all of the reasons that a lot of progressives are. And she was from a fairly poor district in Georgia, and all the money came from New York, and she was voted out. So there's a huge influence.
Or Rashida Tlaib, who's a Palestinian from Michigan, and she was in the most disgusting display by Democrats, censured for saying Palestinian lives matter, which is a sign I have on my yard. And free speech Republicans voted to censure Rashida Tlaib.
Yeah, although the same, I think it was her. Certainly, a few of her associates were happy to be chanting "Death to America" on American streets, which is a good reason to deport them from America, in my opinion.
You're here with two libertarians. I believe who
don't care. If you live in America, hang on, Alana. If you live in America and you chant "Death to America," you are not helpful. You're not contributing. You're not doing anything good.
Well,
You're probably an FBI agent if you do that.
Yeah, you're probably.
agitating. You're agitating. January 6th repetition redux.
I was just sorry to interrupt you. I was just looking at an ad put out by one of these groups asking people to basically put on a kafiyeh and go underground in some of these college campus protests. And, you know, who knows how far that will be? You know, apparently there's been some anti-Semitism, some crude things said at these events. Probably some of it is organic, but you do start to wonder how many of these people are provocateurs who want to really, you know, solely the, you know, the intentions of the protests.
You know, that is such a good point, Daniel, because why this whole Gaza thing has been so revealing to me is one after the other, we've been exposed to Palestinian victims, activists, displaced people, people whose entire family trees have been eradicated. And these, and doctors who've stood and have, you know, ministered to the dying and maimed until they were hit themselves. And these people have been nothing but refined and highly educated and almost, I'm not going to say pacifist, but certainly I wouldn't call them resistance in any way or of a saboteur mindset. I think this has also been illuminating. We've actually come to grips with what the opposition to Israeli occupation looks like.
And anywhere else, if it were any other displaced or beaten down people they were assisting, they would be lionized in the media. They would have Hollywood films made about them, you know, instead of being demonized or ignored, you know.
Although I don't think we should absolutely just forget the small matter of October the 7th as well. You know, I mean, that wasn't particularly brave and challenging to me, slaughtering those people, was it?
Well, the interesting thing about October 7th, and here I give a lot of credit to Max Blumenthal, I think is absolutely courageous, is basically some bad things did happen, but a lot of things that have been claimed were absolutely not true. You had the issue of friendly fire, which was massive. You have, there's so much documentation now about the damage done by friendly fire. It doesn't excuse any time a non-combatant is killed, and certainly if Hamas kills a non-combatant, that should be condemned. But the way the story was projected was not accurate.
That's
at all.
Right.
And
that's,
I think
it was on
purpose to set the scene for the slaughter that followed.
Have you looked at the October 7 forensic examination of the facts, the documents, everything put out by Al Jazeera, in fact, done by a very reputable British journalist. It's absolutely forensic, and there was no proof of mass rape. Absolutely no proof of mass rape. This too, Max Blumenthal at the Gray Zone exposed. And at least they were very conservative in this forensic examination of what happened. About 1,200 people died. About 300, 400 were military men. Absolutely eliminated without, they didn't even have their, you know, their munitions. They weren't even guarding the place. Absolute, no. Asleep on the job. And at least 300 were military. And I think about 18 definitely proven to have been taken from the kibbutzim, didn't reach the Gaza, were vaporized by what looked like from above, fire from above, at least 18.
There were people that were slaughtered on the day. I don't think we should sanitize.
There was no baby beheadings. There was no frying babies in microwaves, which the Israeli propaganda put out.
But was there kidnappings? Do we think anyone was kidnapped, or was that all a psyop? What do we think?
Well, obviously, I mean, the whole operation. This people like Larry Johnson, former CIA. A counterterrorism officer said this was essentially an operation to gather hostages to trade for the Palestinians, the thousands of Palestinians that have been held in Israeli prisons. I mean, this is sort of a tit for tat that's been going on for a long time. Mm. But so it doesn't excuse taking hostages, but you know, it was an operation to get hostages, to get Palestinians out of Israeli jails. And somehow, strangely, it went wrong. And I don't think the truth will ever maybe come out, but certainly we have some inkling of it. And we have testimony from people who were living in the kibbutzes saying that, you know, they came and broke down the walls, you know, and, you know, guys that are flying in on lawn chairs with AK-47s are not spraying the cars like you saw the cars at the festival that were all burned to smithereens. You're not going to have some guys in flying lawn chairs doing that. That was Israeli Hellfire missiles.
Yes, definitely. Yeah. I do recommend the October 7, forensic examination that Al Jazeera did, but conducted by one British journalist, reputable man, and he does show he literally analyzes the damage to the buildings. That is not from the RPG and the whatever the firearms that the Hamas Al Quds brigade had. That was definitely from above.
Yeah. I just happen to think that Hamas themselves, you know, are a fundamental problem. They don't certainly help the Palestinian people, I think, in any regard. And my own stance is that, you know, Daniel, if Hamas were wiped off the face of the earth tomorrow, I'd be quite happy about it.
What does our guest think?
Yeah, I'll ask him a question. You tell me, Daniel.
Well, the problem is it's a response to a very real situation, which is the oppression, the ongoing oppression of the Palestinian people. If Hamas were wiped off the face of the earth, the next day a new group would show up because their beef is legitimate. They're treated very, very badly and have been for decades there. And the reason for this, and this is where, I mean, I don't take either side, but this is where I come in with the non-interventionism, because the reason the Israelis have been able to take such advantage and treat the Palestinians so badly is because of this this moral hazard of having the United States have your back no matter what you do.
Subsidize your evil deeds.
No matter what you do, they subsidize it, you know, and there's a sense that the U.S. will be behind you. So there's no incentive to make peace, to try to be a good neighbor, you know, to not be such a jerk to other people. There's no incentive to doing that. And so my solution would be, perhaps simplistic, would be to have the U.S. completely disengage from Israel. And then there would be some sort of a peace made. And
David, in fact, you agree with that?
Yeah. Well, listen, I think we see it exactly the same. Daniel, Alana, I think the best thing can happen, I think this applies in other circumstances as well, mind you, in other places, but if the U.S. moved away, because Alana made a very good point, Daniel, several weeks ago, I mean, when we did one of these shows, she talked about the fact that, you know, you've got, you know, very important regional powers like Israel, like Iran. Let them sort it out. It's their issue. It's not your issue. It's not our issue. The UK shouldn't be getting involved either. Do you know? And I think that's the best way to get solutions, just like, I think, for what it's worth, you know, if the US in particular kept its nose out of what's happening with the land dispute between Ukraine and Russia, we wouldn't have 500,000 dead Ukrainians, for starters. So I think we all agree in the non-intervention doctrine, but unfortunately, interventionalism is kind of where it is, don't you think, Daniel?
Well, hopefully it's coming to an end. I mean, I think you're seeing, if you look at the polls in the United States, it's pretty astonishing. And I've never seen anything like it before. I mean, I grew up in a generation, and certainly the one that preceded me, the boomers, who are reflexively pro-Israel no matter what. Mm-hmm. And if you look at the polls now, and I mean, we can talk about it, but for that matter, that's one of the reasons they want to ban TikTok, is because young people are not reflexively pro-Israel. And they're getting a lot of information on places like TikTok.
Social media, yeah.
Yeah, they're showing the other side of the story.
Exactly.
And so I mean, I saw, we cited them on our show, a recent Gallup poll was taken, I think, in March, and it showed a vast majority of Democrat-identified voters opposing USA to Israel, but 43% of Republican voters opposing U.S. military aid to Israel. And that is something
really?
Astonishing.
Yeah.
I have never seen that before.
That is a sea change. Yeah. What is also quite heartwarming is not only the mass movement among the youth, because we tend to be sort of wryly cynical about today's bumper crops of ignoramuses being produced by our public schooling, but the campus movement is very inspiring. And what's more, the Jerusalem Post reported that among young evangelicals, I'm not sure if you saw this poll, Daniel, I think it is 7 out of 10 young evangelicals adhere to a post-millennial and amillennial theological view, whereby they don't see the Jewish people and Israel as central to the second coming. Is it second coming? I'm not very good on my Christian theology. So that, because the Christian Zionists are, what do you think about that problem in foreign policy, and what the young people, evangelicals, are signaling to their elders?
Well, that's one unfortunate import from the UK, was the Scofield Bible.
Yeah. You know,
which is an 100%.
Absolutely.
It was a heretical piece of work, you know, and there's no history in 2000 years of the things that were in the Scofield Bible. I mean, it's the cornerstone. I mean, Speaker Johnson himself said, when he was justifying sending this money, he said, well, the Bible tells us that, you know, Christian people, we have to support Israel. If we don't bless them, God will come and kill us. I mean, it's just crazy stuff. I mean,
explain this tract you speak of, the Bible.
Well, it was an annotated Bible produced, I think, in the early part of the 20th century.
That's right.
And this is the, and I'm not an expert, I'm not a theologian, but it's the basis of the evangelical embrace of somehow modern Israel as being, you know, the Israelites of the Bible, and that they must, and you know, in the eschatological, you probably know better than I do, the eschatology of, you know, God will come down, he'll convert all the Jews. Those that don't convert, he'll kill. You know, it's not a happy story.
This guy Scofield was a complete fraud. His so-called doctorate was a complete fraud. But it's really interesting, Alana. It's a good point to make, Daniel. That guy did so much damage because he created something which, again, I think we're all in agreement on this one, you know, Alana, the damage that Scofield Bible has done, and the way then people like the clown Johnson and others, you know, that then basically, you know, use that as their go-to, it's horrendous. It's absolute cringe. But yeah, good point there, Daniel, with Scofield. Yeah.
And that's great to hear that young people aren't buying
it
now. It's interesting
that the Jerusalem Post, I must say, were quite strategic about reporting this. This was not a data point that you and I would look at and think, well, that's very hopeful for American foreign policy. But it was more like, how do we work around this? How do we manipulate?
That is an important point, I think, because what we're seeing now is that they've lost the narrative. Pro-Israel, I don't like using that term, but you know what I mean, extremist. They've lost the narrative. And so now in Western democracies, they're resorting to authoritarian means. And one of them is banning TikTok so that kids can't see that Palestinians are humans too. The other are crackdowns on free speech. You're seeing it on the campuses now across the U.S. These people are being tarred as Jew-hating anti-Semites. And I'm sure there are some in there. But overall, its purpose is to delegitimize the fundamentals of the protest, which is the treatment of the Palestinian people in Gaza. But you're seeing these moves in democracies that are absolutely anti-democratic, intense government pressure of social media to censor people and things of that nature. And I think it's because they've lost control of the narrative and they're panicking and resorting to these totalitarian methods.
I'm sure you're right. Well, one question I had, Daniel, was I think the U.S. National debt, it's about 36 trillion, something like that. And I'm wondering, how does a country with a national debt of 36 trillion vote for extra funds of 61 billion to head off to Ukraine, to Israel and Taiwan or whatever? Economically, how does that work? And who actually controls the U.S. budget? Is it the U.S. or is it Israel?
Or is it the Federal Reserve, or is it all of the above?
It reminds
me when I got my first credit card and I said, well, I've got money now, and I get spending. And then I said, oh, crap.
So much of it just stays in the country and inflates the military industrial complex, congressional complex. Much will reach, you know, make a difference in Ukrainian battlefield.
But it makes people wealthy. I think that's the point in all of this, isn't it? People within the industrial, political, And we could, in other broadcasts, have talked about the pharmaceutical complex as well, because there's money in that. They just do this thing and they enrich themselves. It's kind of top-down economics, but it doesn't work in the interests of the people. And as I said, I worry, Daniel, about the fact that the U.S. financially is in such a terrible state because of the massive spending that has, you know, I mean, I saw a thing on Twitter today. I'm on Twitter, by the way, Daniel. If you look me up, I'm okay. Sure you'll find me. I think it was a Thomas Jefferson basically saying that, you know, it was essentially morally wrong to encumber any debt on American people. And then look at your debt. And yeah. You think, wow, your actual government's working against America. I think that's something surely that we can all agree on as well.
And it can't be paid back. It's literally impossible. Too and much. The interest payments on our debt will surpass our military budget next year is what I read. I mean, and that is astonishing. It's astonishing. Yeah. It's you can't sustain. And every 100 days, we put another $1 trillion on the balance sheet in debt. I mean, this cannot be sustained. And I think that has a lot. I think that does drive, I'm not necessarily a conspiratorialist, but I think that does drive policy to a degree. You've got to find some way of hiding this debt somehow because it can't be repaid.
But the Austrian cycle, which of course you and I probably, I'm not speaking for you, but we certainly adhere to. The thing is, they can never tell thinkers in this tradition, the Austrian business cycle, when the collapse will happen.
Yeah.
I mean, it seems like we've moved into a system, an economic system, where all of the central banks in the world are inflating in tandem, at least the Western. And that's why the BRIC has to resist and all that and oppose the dollar maybe they don't have any incentive to put the brakes. They think they can inflate forever.
That may be the case, but you know, the center can't hold either. If you look at inflation in the U.S., I mean, it's the middle class, and obviously in the working middle class that's bearing the brunt of it. And I'm here in the U.S., I'm here in Texas. Every time I go to the grocery store, I'm shocked at the price for very simple foods. You know, I you know, prepare everything from scratch. I don't, you know, but it's astonishing the real inflation that we're facing here. You know, and sorry, our salaries aren't going up to equalize it. It's unbelievable.
Yeah. I mean, tell me this. Do you think, you've obviously got an election coming up this year. Do you think if Donald Trump, by some miracle, won, do you think we would see changes with regard to what's happening in Ukraine, what's happening in Gaza? Do you think that would that be a game changer, or would it just be more of the same?
It wouldn't be more of the same, but it wouldn't be the miracle that we're hoping for. And my hopes have been a little bit dashed in the way that Trump has handled the Mike Johnson situation. Apparently, at least from what I've heard, Lindsey Graham convinced Donald Trump to not oppose this Ukraine money. We'll call it a loan. You know, that'll appease everyone. But he didn't come out. He's been opposed to this. This is literally a political gift to Biden. It's pulling Biden's chestnuts out of the fire.
Yes.
They didn't want the collapse to come on his watch. So somehow this happening and Donald Trump not standing up and saying, I oppose it, doesn't bode well on this. On Israel, I think he's more of a wild card because on the one hand, he's the most rabidly pro-Israel. He'd be the first to say it. President in history, I'm the greatest, pro-Israel. But on the other hand, He's such a wild card that he might come up with something crazy like listen, Netanyahu, damn it, stop doing this, or something that Biden could never do.
I think, don't you think that with him it's personal? Netanyahu has made the United States its bitch. With Trump being such an alpha male, it's personal. I'll show you who's the boss. And I think Bill Clinton, who also had interactions with Bibi Netanyahu, once returned to his staffers and said, excuse my swearing, who the F does he think he is? Who's the superpower here? You know, that was Bill Clinton. So I imagine Bill Clinton probably was the last manly president we had,
I think Trump probably also qualifies as that. And don't forget, during his first term, and I hope there will be a second, but who knows?
You do?
Put it like this. During Trump's first term, where was the U.S. overseas adventurism? Where was it? Didn't happen, did it? So for all the profile, and I'm not, you know.
Daniel might have a different perspective. What about Niger, Syria?
Yeah, I mean, he did a lot of dumb things, but I think you're both right. He didn't start a major war.
When
he felt the pressure to bomb Syria after the chemical attack hoax, I think he knew that it was BS, and he said, okay, just show me somewhere where there's not a lot of people, drop a bomb, okay, it's over. So he's not the hero that we want, but I guess he's the hero we deserve in a way.
Yeah.
I hope he wins because I hate Biden so much. He's such a scumbag that, you know, that's my reason is hate.
But on Gaza, there was, I'm not sure, there was an interview with Trump had with two APAC stooges.
Yeah, interesting.
And he said very clearly, but that's the thing with Trump. He has that knack for, appealing to every side of the political spectrum. Yeah. That's why he's such a brilliant politician.
It was an astonishing interview.
Yeah, he basically, you recall, he said, this is not looking good for you. Yeah. You need to wrap this up. But then he went on and said, finish the job. What did you make of that, Daniel?
Well, you could interpret it charitably, meaning, you know, wrap this thing up, you know, finish the job. I mean, maybe he's, you know, that's how he is. But it was astonishing for him to, and it wasn't because, unlike the three of us, because he had enormous compassion for the people that were suffering. It was, like you say, this is looking bad, guys. I can't afford to look bad.
Yeah.
So he kind of got to take it, take what you get. But what I'm worried about, is that he has a lot of flatterers now that he looks like he's on the ascendance. And I'm really concerned that his next foreign policy team will be as bad as his last one. I was reading an article talking about how O'Brien might come back as his national security advisor. O'Brien is a disaster. He's an extreme China hawk, but he's also the guy, a good friend of mine is Colonel Doug McGregor, who end of the Trump administration had a very short period of time where he was a senior advisor to the acting defense secretary, and Trump told him with 2 weeks left, Doug, you got to get us out of Syria and Afghanistan. And the colonel said, I'll try to come up with a plan. And he actually did come up with a plan, but O'Brien put the kibosh on it. So O'Brien is a bad guy.
And then he had his family, you know, the familia in the White House. And, Ivanka cried, so he bombed Syria.
Yeah, yeah.
Who knows if let's not forget that one member of his family, Jared Kushner, is eyeing real estate in Gaza.
Yeah, he's literally he said
ocean view property. So, as you say, Daniel, I'm better than Biden, but not much.
Yeah. I mean, I had a lot of hope for RFK Jr., but that went like this. Unfortunately.
What do you make about his? Even Kucinich left him, right? What happened there? Why is he so? Is he bought and paid for?
That's what some people, and I won't say the name, but I was talking to a very, very prominent media personality not too long ago, who thought that he was being blackmailed or something was being held against him. All of that's possible. Mm-hmm. Who knows? But you know, as I said at the time, it's so unnecessary. I said he could just take the Ron Paul view. Yes, of course. Exactly. I support Israel. Of course. I wish them the best, you know, but I think we can best help them by not bothering them. Or if I was RFK, I would say, well, of course I support Israel, but I'm a different kind of candidate. I'm a peace candidate. Everything we've done thus far hasn't worked well. It hasn't brought peace. So while still being pro-Israel, I want to take a different kind of approach. Boom. You know, it's a win-win. But instead, he brings on this insane rabbi, all about his daughter and this and that. And the guy is a very nasty piece of work, very extremist. And I absolutely don't understand it. It's unnecessary. If he hadn't done that, I think he would be a serious threat to to the presidency.
And that's the thing about these front people in the Israeli Hasbara and the propaganda. You look at them and you think the banality of evil, Daniel, the mediocrity of these people, and Rabbi Shmuel is plain vulgar. I mean, he's a pornographer.
Yeah. Well.
So, and the same thing, the war pornography that's coming out of the Israeli PR, and you know, you trace some of them, like the one of their propagandists, their mouths, they go straight into DC think tanks. They're operating, they're straddling both Israel mm-hmm. and the United States in terms of their source of income and their allegiances. How does that work? How can an Israeli, an individual who's a spokesperson for the IDF, become a member of an American think tank? How does that work? You are familiar with the laws.
Yeah, I don't know specifically, but I know that it happens a lot, you know, and I remember, this is not exactly related to what you're saying, but I remember we were in a staff meeting for the House Foreign Affairs Committee, and it was a bill dealing with Israel. I don't remember the exact details. And the other staffers were there, and the staff directors were there briefing us on this bill. And the very first thing that came out of their mouths was, before they even said anything about the bill, "Don't worry, guys, AIPAC, it looks at this and they approve it." And that was it. I mean, it's like, okay, get up and leave. You know, that's how. And I would say I wouldn't support any attempts to silence AIPAC or make what they do illegal, because I think they have the right of free speech just like everyone else. But the people who are to blame are the members who sell themselves out.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So what about registering as a foreign agent when you do such destructive agitation?
I mean, that seems reasonable. Isn't that what Kennedy was looking to do before he got off? I don't know, but could be a danger.
Was he?
I don't know. I mean, maybe I'm misremembering it, but I think that's what he was looking at. But I don't see, everyone else would have to. I mean, everyone else working for any other government would have to. I don't see why they shouldn't have to do that.
Speaking of this, what about the Israel First Press? I thought that after Iraq, and I was new to the United States when the Iraq war was engineered, and my jaw still has not completely stopped dropping. I mean, this was just a parallel reality that the United States created, and I think Karl Rove admitted, we are empire, we create reality, and we force the world to enter this third dimension. And nothing has changed in terms of it's actually worse, because, you know, I wrote up a storm throughout the years in the build-up to the war and afterwards, years after. My work was published by conservative press, and now nobody will touch anti-Israel, or at least criticism of Israel. How do you explain that? How is that possible in the United States of America?
Not even slightly critical. But, you know, the one thing that has changed since the Iraq war era is the rise of alternative media, and alternative media has surpassed in reach. Now, not in terms of profits, but if you look at someone like Tucker Carlson, his reach is enormous. I mean, it's bigger than all the networks combined. And he does things like he had this Syriac priest, this Melkite priest on, who was a mild-mannered. He simply said that, you know, there are a lot of Christians here too, guys, you know. And look how and millions and millions of people watched it. So
tens of millions,
Exactly. Yeah. So there is a silver lining, and that's why they want to shut down the alternative media. That's why they want to shut down social media and Twitter and TikTok and the others.
But sorry, Alana, but it is a fair point, actually, that alternative media, and particularly social media, has had such an impact, and we've been able to see things. And Alana, we have seen, you know, the atrocities carried out in Gaza. We see what's going on in Ukraine as well. I mean, the mainstream media don't want to talk about it. And, you know, essentially, I believe if Ukraine ever started, I mean, they lost within about a month, I reckon. But the fiction still carries on. In the
I like your, both your positivity, David and Daniels, and maybe I'm this Cassandra, but I seem to resent the fact that so many of us have lost careers over... we just libertarians just speak the truth. We don't think of who's going to pad our banks. But what about someone so powerful like Tucker Carlson? As you said, 81 million followers or viewers on a podcast.
Yeah.
6 months into the conflict, he has this mild mannered, as you said, absolute genteel priest to speak about a Christian community in Gaza and in the West Bank. And has shied away from saying anything. Imagine the what do you make about that? Of that, is that someone so powerful like as Tucker Carlson is afraid? What has he got to be afraid of?
It's a good question. I don't know, but I think it took a lot of courage to have the priest on. He's had a lot of other people like that on, So I think he does have a huge, I mean, look what happened after this priest was on. The entire bought and paid for conservative media, the grifters, they went nuts. The Ben Shapiro's of the world went nuts, you know.
Yes.
Do you see what John Potter said? He retweeted.
I didn't.
He said he's a filthy anti-Semite, is what he said about Tucker Carlson.
Yeah. I mean,
of all the things that Tucker is potentially.
Yeah, but that must stop, because anti-Semitism is a thought crime. Leave it alone. People should have their, I don't think any, anti-Israel is not anti-Semitism.
Criticism
of Israel is not. But that's the thing. I guess you are more gracious about, very powerful. I was very hopeful when Candace Owens began. She interviewed Finkelstein.
Yeah.
She did and she was curious about what was going on, and she probed, and of course she was a bit. But she hasn't picked up on that either. So maybe they're just uninterested. Maybe they're literally America first. But America first, you have to be also not Israel first.
Well, she's taken some gutsy stands, and I'm sure she walked away from a very attractive paycheck.
Lucrative, yeah.
She did. Yeah, she did. I actually think that goes back to Tucker Carlson as well. I think Tucker Carlson has done a formidable job building up his new outside of Fox platform on X/Twitter. And I listened to his podcast most recently with Joe Rogan. Really interesting one, actually. They cover a whole lot of topics. And it's perfectly obvious that Tucker Carlson knows there's certain limitations in where he can go and where he can't go. He knows that. And indeed, so does Joe Rogan for that. There's some things thou shalt not talk about. And even on alternative media, you know, you'd be pushing too far, not necessarily from the
like. Why are you doing this? Why? I don't.
Well, I think there's powerful forces, Alana. That's what I think. I'm not talking about Elon Musk or anything like that. I'm saying there are other forces around. There's the good old CIA and other organizations that can shut you down and can make life very, very difficult. So, you know, even in the alternative media space, it is sometimes more difficult than what it might seem to have honest, like we're having an honest conversation here. There's no limitations on us. But, you know, if you've got an audience the size of Tucker Carlson, then other interests will be watching that very carefully and watching.
Well, that goes to what Daniel said, and I'd be interested to hear what, Daniel, you have to say about, you mentioned that our government does mirror to an extent ourselves. We get the government and the and civil society that we deserve. What about Tucker treading a very delicate balance with his own audience? What is your opinion about that? It's not only the powers that be, but his own followers.
Yeah, I think that's the case. But there's also, I mean, as you say, of course, the intelligence agencies can make life miserable for you. Anything can happen to you. Just ask Julian Assange about that. But there's also the issue of, you know, sort of for rhetorical purposes, for didactic purposes. If you're going to teach people and bring them along with you, you don't want to feed them, too much at a go. And I think he's testing the waters that he could never test on Fox News now. And it's not just foreign policy, but it's even immigration and other things. He's testing the waters and getting a little bit more each time that he goes. And, you know, we actually flew down and we met him. Dr. Paul was on his show in February. And so we spent a good couple of hours chatting with him and chatting with his crew and his staff. And I was enormously impressed by what a genuine, unless he's the greatest actor in the world, he's a genuinely decent,
nice,
humble,
man.
you know, wonderful person.
Yeah, I just think all these wealthy people should do something about Gaza. It's just an unbearable reality. One last thing I do want to ask you about the national interest perspective. So Matt Walsh, a commentator, I don't know if you, I don't pay much attention to these people, but he has a position on as a creator, I guess, on the talentless, now that Candace is gone, it's a talentless platform, Ben Shapiro, talentless platform, possibly, I don't know, Israel First platform, certainly could be even Israel funded, but I can't say. But he apparently, Candace Owen crossed some sort of threshold whereby she empathized with Palestinian babies, she herself being a mother, and she dared to empathize with and was called unsophisticated and anti-Semitic for that. I think that was her only crime, as well as the interview with Norm Finkelstein. But Matt Walsh retained his, you know, his credibility and his platform with Pope Shapiro by just saying, well, I don't think we should be there. He managed to, so maybe Ben Shapiro will countenance the position that, you know, so long as we don't intervene, but we can't say anything about Israel. But how do we get anywhere if we don't make value statements?
Yeah, and it's I mean, this Conservatism Inc. grifters is a real problem, and it's not just Daily Wire, but if you look at any of these organizations, I mean, I was on, OAN, One American Network, which is a right-wing network, and I was invited on many, many times. Very nice host. She always had me back. I won't say her name, but very nice. But she was very pro-Israel, maybe even from there, from what I know. I don't know. But as soon as this happened, I have never been invited back. You know, it's just, you are an enemy. I mean, I've lost some friends, you know, cyber friends, because people snapped when this happened, and they sort of reverted.
You mean October 7?
Yeah. I mean, it's a very strange situation, you know, that's happened. How it's
different. Why is it so different to, well, when we opposed the war in Iraq, which was unjust, not in the national interest, unjust, absolute travesty as it was happening.
Yugoslavia, Libya, and all of them.
Why were we allowed to express ourselves more so than now?
It is strange, but think about how radical it was, you know, 30 some years ago when Pat Buchanan referred to Congress as Israel controlled territory. And nowadays that almost seems like a sort of a benign thing.
A truism. Yeah. Tell us about your, maybe before we have to let you go, tell us a little bit about your anti-war roots. You mentioned Pat Buchanan.
Yeah, definitely. Pat Buchanan was a start, but you know, I was living in Hungary working as a journalist. And ironically, this is sort of a funny aside, but I've never mentioned anything about it. I was pro-Israel at the time. I thought Netanyahu was a pretty neat guy back in 96. And in fact, I'm sure I'm somewhere listed in the annals of Israeli diplomatic or intelligence history, because I would regularly meet with the political officer of the Israeli embassy in Budapest, and he would take me to lunch, and I would tell him, because I was very active in the politics and the scene there, and I would give him my rundown of things. So I was a little naive back then, but he was a super nice guy, and we got along very well. In fact, when I was in Budapest, I even did some work for the ADL, believe it or not.
I won't tell anybody.
Actually, that was kind of my wake-up call in a way. That's where I started the question, because I was working on a book with them called Skinhead International. And it was about the rise of anti-Semitism in the former communist countries. And so I painstakingly looked at every instance of anti-Semitic attacks in Hungary over the year and compared it to previous, all the police reports, all objective, all directly from the police, and compared it to previous years. And I discovered that actually had gone down significantly. And so I wrote up my report, and my report is like, this is great news. You know, people are actually more tolerant. There's less attacks on Jews in Hungary. This is a success story. And when the book came out, the Hungary section was completely the opposite, 180 degrees from what I wrote. And even though I have a credit in the book, it was anti-Semitism is on the rise in Hungary.
It was a lie.
It was a lie. Yeah.
Yeah.
Interesting. What made you go to Hungary, because your surname certainly isn't of that. McAdams isn't Hungarian.
Well, my other side does have Hungarian roots. Okay. And so that's one of the things that brought me there. But also the end of the Cold War, it had just ended, and it was an amazing opportunity to get over there and do a lot of really fascinating things. I spent a lot of time working in the war zones in the Balkans as a journalist and a human rights monitor. You could do things at that time that, you know, you couldn't do anywhere else, really. So it was a great time for young adventurers without children.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting, though, Daniel, that those countries, those former Soviet countries, they all understood that what it was like to live under a tyranny. And it seems to me that those of us in the West perhaps are going to have to be taught that lesson because we don't seem to value that which we have. Anyway, we've reached the end of our allocated time. We could probably have gone on for another hour. It's been fantastic chatting, Daniel. So thank you so much for joining with Alana and myself.
I echo that, Daniel. Thank you. It was lovely meeting you face to face.
Thank you.
Hopefully one day we'll meet in real life.
Yes.
Digital absolutely. Is wonderful. It really enables so much, but it does sort of denude us of personal contact. So.
Absolutely. If you're ever over in the UK, Daniel, look me up. I'll be here.
Absolutely.
Thank you for the work you do.
Yes, indeed. And thank you so much for your time tonight. We both totally appreciate it. It's been a wonderful conversation. So likewise. Listen, that's it from Alana, Daniel, myself from Hard Truth. See you all again. Bye-bye.